Okay, good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Why is this night different than all other nights? No, this is the wrong script. I'm sorry. I'm here to provide an introduction to David Kirkpatrick, who's been a good friend of mine for over a decade. And let me just tell you some amazing things about David Kirkpatrick. I met David Kirkpatrick because he was the absolute preeminent journalist in the technology industry, working for Fortune magazine. He did that for almost longer than any other journalist that Fortune magazine had, and probably wrote more cover stories than any other of Fortune's journalists. In fact, he wrote over 10 cover stories.
The one that I remember
was when I was coming out of college in 1987, how to retire in 1987. Didn't quite get there yet. I still haven't gotten there, David. David has been a prophet. He has been a visionary. He has been an instigator. He has mostly been a tremendous catalyst for change and growth in the technology industry. Amazing as a journalist. And the way he's done that is not by writing just great stories, or you might find him moderating an amazing panel at the World Economic Forum in Davos, but he also created a whole set of conferences as part of a Fortune magazine called Brainstorm, which took place in Aspen, Colorado, and brought the top thinkers in the world together to debate the most important issues in the world. And I can tell you the most interesting thing about David was way before anyone else thought Facebook was cool and was going to take over the world, David was on the case. In fact, I remember very specifically in 2007 and 2008, David's fever for Facebook started to increase. And it was not a surprise to me at all that he would later leave his job at Fortune to write this amazing book. We were very fortunate in our household to see an early copy of it because my wife was one of the first readers, Lynn, who's right here in the front row, and she was blown away at the not just the research, but really the very compelling prose and how it really articulated what happened in Facebook
and how it got created. You read it too, right?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I read the whole thing, cover to cover. So I am absolutely delighted to introduce you all to David Kirkpatrick, and I know we're going to have a fantastic forum. We also have Michael Arrington, who you met here, who is the founder of
TechCrunch.
Is that what it's called?
Yep.
Okay, good. So anyway, we have everyone from all the way from New York City, by the way. Would you all please welcome David Kirkpatrick? Thank you.
I lost my script. I've literally lost the script that I was reading. Did you take it?
No.
I've literally lost it. I think I'm supposed to hit the. I swear, I'm not joking now. And this is bad because you guys stressed me out about how important the script was. If there's a printout of the script, could I have a? Oh, thanks, Mark.
Have mine, please.
How did I lose it? From up there to here. Anyway, okay, so I think you speak now.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good. I'm happy to. Shall I start?
It said here, it says you're supposed to speak for 5 or 10 minutes about the book.
Okay,
yeah.
Good.
And then I get to grill you on it / interview you on it.
So. That's fine. So I'm just really, I got to have Mark introduce me everywhere I go, by the way. So I did get excited about Facebook pretty early on, you know, excited in the sense that I had a feeling that it was going to get more important than most people realized. And that really flowed from a meeting I had with Mark Zuckerberg in September of 2006. I was guy who had covered Microsoft and Apple and Intel and IBM and all those companies. And I kind of knew a lot of tech entrepreneurs and very interested in them, admired them. But I really strongly felt when I met Mark that he was of the highest order in that category, and that really he really reminded me. This is, I really felt the first meeting that he reminded me of Bill Gates, and it was the way he talked about his company reminded me of the way Bill Gates actually talked about his company more before I knew him. But one of the things that I really think is incredibly parallel between Zuckerberg and Gates is the big picture vision that animated the company from day one. And in Microsoft's case, it was a computer on every desk and in every home, which was truly a revolutionary vision at the time and really was all about empowerment, which, and clearly, it was a very impactful vision. And I actually think that the single most similar thing about Mark is that he also has a vision that's about empowerment, which is about sharing and connecting people using a new kind of tool. And actually then, once I was so impressed by him, I started writing about the company quite a bit, and I did have the privilege of getting a lot of inside access to the company both then and in the course of writing this book. But it is really this empowerment thing that drew me to Facebook primarily. And I think that, you know, most people even still don't see Facebook in its most revolutionary dimension, in my opinion. And it's so easy, particularly for us in the United States, where Facebook did begin as a college service, to see it as a plaything for kids. And that was the universal view until quite recently. And it's surprising how many people who don't use Facebook still think of it that way in the United States. It's not thought that way anywhere else in the world. Which is why the U.S. has a relatively low percentage of overall users of Facebook as a percent of the population compared to other developed countries like U.K., for example, is about, I think, 8 percentage points higher penetration than in the U.S. Canada is much higher than the United States. But what I mean by empowerment is that among the many other things that it does, Facebook gives each person a broadcast platform. And that seems trivial if all they're doing is broadcasting to their other high school friends about, you know, the party last night or how blotto they got or whatever, which, of course, is what got this thing started, college and high school kids doing that kind of thing. But it works for a lot of other kinds of information also. And, you know, it's very possible, by the way, that Facebook might even be at its peak now. Who knows? But it has essentially pioneered, in a mass scale, an entirely new kind of communication. And that's, to me, its most important quality for me as a journalist and the reason I was so drawn to it. Another way I think about the communication that Facebook enables and how it differs from what we've done in the past is that whenever you initiated a communication to an individual in the past, whether it was a letter or a phone call or a telegram or an email, you made an outbound effort to send something to another person. Facebook reverses that process in what I see as a fairly profound way. By becoming your friend on Facebook, somebody effectively subscribes to information about you. And then all you do is do things. You say something about yourself. You just say it on Facebook. And Facebook then automatically sends it to a significantly large number of people, which can be determined a number of ways. It can be determined by people's settings and who they've said they're interested in. But actually, more often than not, it's determined algorithmically and has a lot to do with activity that people have had on the site previously. So that, for example, if a friend of yours has commented on a status update you've made or said they liked it or whatever, that person is more likely to see your changes in your site, in your page, than somebody else. And I think that's kind of amazing. I call it bringing automation to communication. So that to me is just a couple of thoughts about why I find Facebook fundamentally different than anything that's preceded it. Now, there are other services that have some elements that are quite parallel to those that I just said, but Facebook's the only one that has really reached a mass scale. And even when I started writing the book, Facebook was at about, I think, 55 million when I first had the idea of writing the book and really launched on it. And that was already a surprisingly large number of people, and here it is 10 times larger now. And that scale in itself becomes a very noteworthy fact, which in many ways I'm sure we'll discuss. So basically that's my introductory remarks, and now, you know, slay me.
So first of all, congratulations on the book. It's an outstanding piece of work and perfectly timed, in my opinion, with Facebook hitting 500 million users. You just couldn't imagine a better time for a book to come out with, talk about the history of this, of the very, still very young service. With that in mind, you and I know each other fairly well. We go back a couple years now, not as long as you do with Mark, but I respect the hell out of you. You're a terrific journalist. You know I love the book. I've read it twice now. You caught me reading it.
Yeah, that impressed me that you've read it twice.
We happened to randomly be on the same airplane the other day coming here, and you sort of caught me reading it.
Yeah, that was weird, actually.
I'm going to go a little harder on you than you have been, than people have been on you.
I expected that.
I've interviewed you about the book at our conference at Disrupt before I had read it because it wasn't out yet, but we talked a little bit about parts of it. And you've been talking to a lot of people about the book. And as far as I can tell, there's a lot of what I would consider to be softball questions. I'd like to add those as well to give the audience a bit of flavor about the book. But I want to really dive in on a couple of things that concern me about it as well. And so hopefully we'll have a meaningful conversation here. But you know that we're friends. You know that we go way back.
You don't have to add the caveats anymore. Just ask me the question.
But I think it's good to the audience on that. Also, I've been accused of going way too soft on Facebook in the recent past around their privacy issues. And so I think some of the things you write even made me raise my eyebrows, and so that's why I think it's worth talking about here. That being said, you've sort of finished the book before a lot of this stuff happened recently as well, in your defense. But let's start off on a couple of nice notes. So you actually decided to write this book a year and a half or 2 years ago.
No, I decided I wanted to write it probably in late 07, yep. And it was in January of 08 that I talked to Mark, and he said he would cooperate. And at that point, once I knew he would cooperate, I felt I had to write it. It was such an amazing, unique opportunity.
Well, but at that time, it wasn't quite that clear. I mean, as you said, it probably had 50 million users 2 years ago.
50 million.
That's a lot.
I mean, it was clear to me.
I
felt sort of an insight that I ought to run with, you know?
Yeah. But you left Fortune, and at least filled in full time, and you were one of, if not the most senior tech people there. As Mark said, you're sort of a famous journalist, and so to dedicate a couple of years of your life to this means you really believe in it, and I think the book reflects that you really think there's something to Facebook, not just as a business, but culturally.
I think it kind of maybe might matter someday.
Early on in the book, one of the criticisms I've had of this, of the book, one of the only criticisms, it's sort of one-sided. It feels like you talked to Facebook a lot about the book, but you didn't necessarily talk to some of the detractors at all. So I'd like to dive into that a little bit. But just to get a flavor, early on in the book, you were so enthusiastic about what Facebook has done that you actually talk about it possibly bringing up, world peace.
I might have misquoted
you a little bit, but if you just quote it perfectly, as Facebook grows and grows past 500 million members, one has to ask if there may not be a macro version of the Facebook effect. Could it become a factor in helping bring together a world filled with political and religious strife and in the midst of environmental and economic breakdown? A communication system that includes people of all countries, all races, all religions could not be a bad thing, could it? I hand wrote next to that last part about a communication system that includes all people. I wrote the telephone, right? Does that as well.
It's probably played a fairly significant role in pacifying the world, too, I would argue.
Unpack this statement a little bit. We talk about
that's actually from the end of the book, after I've told a whole lot of other stuff. And I think in kind of near proximity to that, I have a paragraph or two at least of serious caveats. I also say toward the end of the book that Facebook could very likely become, in fact, I believe it will become seriously subject to regulation and governmental pushback. And you've made fun of me for thinking this before, because anyway, so I think Facebook has huge, obstacles in front of it, and it is really a good question to ask whether the functions that it fulfills even today, and certainly the functions that it aspires to have long term, should be performed by a company at all. Their ambition is so big over there that, a lot of things they think they should do have always been done, like on the internet, with just commonly accepted standards, for example. And this idea of retaining a repository of identity, the government has always been the one that did that. So, you know, I mean, now, of course, there's other forms of identity that were maintained by commercial entities. But so I think Facebook has a lot of challenging issues in front of it. But I really do believe that I'm glad you read that quote. Actually, I forgot that I haven't read the book in a few weeks. I read it when I did the audiobook. But, you know, I guess one of the things that really drew me to Facebook is I think the world is in kind of deep trouble. You know, I think we live in a very, very fragile, you know, fragmented, contentious, armed world. And, you know, it's not a minor matter. And if a service could emerge that really could help people communicate better, I absolutely, unequivocally believe that could be a good thing. And it probably is. And I think in Facebook's case, demonstrably has been in a number of ways. I mean, there is a flaw with that statement. And actually, it's somewhat of an echo of something Peter Thiel says in the book. And I think it comes right after I quote him, if I recall correctly. Or I quote him saying similar things. Given that Facebook is meant to be a place to communicate with the people you already know in the real world, there is a logical flaw with what I said there, because you're not going to make a whole lot of new friends if you're using Facebook the way it was designed. On the other hand, it does allow you to aggregate around issues of common interest, regardless of whether you know people, on pages and in many other ways. And, you know, I mean, I'm fascinated by things that have happened, like, for example, on the West Bank and East Jerusalem, there was a huge issue when people, Jews in settlements on the West Bank, were not allowed at a certain point to say they lived in Israel on Facebook. And they had to say they were in Palestine, I believe. And they protested that. Meanwhile, people in East Jerusalem were really annoyed. They had to say they lived in Israel. And Facebook had to adjudicate this. And they ended up deciding that in those two places, you could say you lived in either of two countries. I just, you know, that's a very minor case, but it suggests the issues that emerge when you have a system like this, and I find that fascinating.
What about the fact, this is off question, but Facebook has allowed Holocaust denial groups to remain on the site as long as they sort of behave.
Right.
Do you think what do you personally think about that?
Well, Facebook's rules are if you don't advocate breaking the law, you're within their terms of service. I know you've got strong opinions about that.
You can't show,
I don't have an opinion about any. I mean, I kind of think it's reasonable to adhere to a fairly standard set of rules, and that advocating breaking the law is the limit. Facebook itself recently contradicted its own policy in Pakistan, where they turned off a group called Everybody Draw Mohammed Day, because the government and many of the people of Pakistan were starting to talk about killing Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, not government, but there were rallies in Pakistan, you know, burning logos of Facebook, because in Pakistan, the perception in some circles was that this was a page created by Facebook, because they didn't realize, you know, Facebook's just a platform. It's something that allows anybody to broadcast their views on anything. And even though that was within the terms of service, Facebook turned it off in Pakistan and I believe in Bangladesh and maybe other places. And, you know, I think that's a little bit questionable, but I also think this is the weird set of challenges that you get when you have a service that transcends all these borders. And, you know, so that's a way of answering.
You, we're almost, there's just a couple more of the sort of hard questions, and we can get into the really fun stuff. But early on, you talk about the just slew of lawsuits that hit Facebook about the early days. At least two accusing Mark of stealing ideas. There was the early business guy, what was his name?
Eduardo Severin.
Yeah, Severin. He sued as well.
There's really three major complainants. Yeah.
But the Winklevoss, did I pronounce that right?
Yeah.
You know, I never say that out loud.
That's their name.
You know, they had hired Mark, although they never paid him, to do some work on something that might have been similar to Facebook. And they eventually launched ConnectU, although it shut down. And then, you know, Aaron Greenspan with House System. You present, in my opinion, in these cases, I'm generally pro-Facebook, but you present an extremely one-sided view
of these
lawsuits. Well, you seem to suggest that the cases had no real basis in fact.
Well, that's not leaving something out. That's making an argument.
You go on, you talk quite a bit about how no one really invented social networking. I mean, this stuff is like, it's a long history of social networking back to the 90s, even the 60s. But it almost feels like the story, just the facts of it, were one-sided. Now, and we talked about this on the plane. You said you didn't talk to Winklevoss, any of the plaintiffs in these cases, or Greenspan.
No, I didn't.
What made you decide, in a book that's so important about the history of Facebook?
You know, it's a good question, and perhaps I should have, just so I could say that I did. But in the case of Winklevoss twins and Divya Narendra, who were the major ones that really one has to wrestle with, there had been huge lawsuits, enormous discovery and testimony, much of which I had, which described in great detail, in their words, under oath, what their complaints were. So I did, and I really researched that very in depth, and I didn't frankly feel that I needed to talk to them to have them repeat the same points to me. Yeah. I mean, if this was the best case they could make in court, I figured it was good enough for me in the case of the Winklevoss and Narendra. So that was my thinking, and maybe it was wrong not to talk to them, but that's what I did.
One of the really fascinating things from early on in the book, you talk about
Can I just say one more thing about
you
that?
Can say anything
because
you
you're
want
right.
To say.
I mean, the fundamental way that I sort of treat this issue of did Mark steal the idea of Facebook is not really to address, perhaps maybe as much as I should have, you know, whether he's an asshole. Is that a word you can say here?
No.
I think it is. But anyway. But it's more that, once you really get the full history of social networking, and I didn't give the full history, but I gave more history than most people know about things like Club Nexus, which emerged at Stanford in 2001, designed by Orchid Buchuchten, which had pretty much all the features that the Winklevoss brothers and Narendra were trying to put in their service almost 3 years later. And yet they argued in court that they were the inventors of the idea of a college social network where you're authenticated by your college email address, which is factually incorrect. There's a lot of things like that. And the other thing that I think I talk about is that social networks, like so many great ideas, they were in the ether. A lot of people had ideas about this at the same time. And the same year that Facebook emerged, before Facebook launched, there were social networks launched at Baylor University, at Yale, at Columbia, and at quite a few other places that were pretty serious products that were, the one at Columbia actually gave Facebook a run for its money briefly, and they were quite paranoid about it in 2004. And then, there's a lot of other people that tried to compete very hard with Facebook, but the point is that, when you see it all in context, the way I put it now is Mark possibly, maybe, or maybe it arguably did steal ideas or certainly sandbagged the Winklevosses in Narendra.
But sorry, could you just repeat that?
I think he probably sandbagged them. And, if the IMs that have come out recently on Business Insider.
Yeah.
I said, but let me finish. If he stole anything, there's nothing he stole that they didn't steal, wittingly or unwittingly, from somebody else. So that to me, that's kind of the major way I deal with it.
Making a right?
It's not two wrongs making a right. It's that, and they came out of it damn well, after all. I mean, they settled their lawsuit.
Where in the book do you say that he
probably stole their stock they got from Facebook's worth over $100 million now, easily, I would bet. I mean, we don't know exactly how much it was, but it's gone up a lot in value since they got it. And they obviously had some degree of a case, or they wouldn't have settled. But on the, a lot of times companies settle things just to get it, out of their way, because it's a huge distraction. And that case was a major distraction for Facebook during its critical early growth years. It's kind of amazing when you think about it. In the fall of 2004, I believe they started paying $20,000 a month for legal fees. And this was when, they weren't even spending that much monthly on their servers. It's probably the single biggest expense. But not that, lawsuits are fine. I think it's been also so endlessly discussed. I felt that I do deal with it in some length in the book. and I feel that, you know, I expressed my point of view. If somebody wants to go interview them and argue it in more detail, if Nicholas Carlson at Business Insider, who's been leaking, you know, publishing all these leaked IM messages, wants to say where he's getting them from, or the person who had those IMs wants to come forward and identify themselves, we could learn a lot more about this.
Okay.
And I would include it in the next edition of the book.
Okay, we're going to move on now. I got a couple good quotes out of you on that one, though.
Okay,
fascinating. The service launches at Harvard. Within a month,
it has more water.
I'd love some too. You just throw your glass. You're like, I'm done with this. I'm done with this. Don't get angry.
I'm not. It's a little light piece of plastic.
Within a month, they had 10,000 users.
Is that what I say? Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah.
And then after 4 months, somebody, I think you've mentioned who, offered $10 million for this.
Yeah, actually, I've subsequently learned there was another $25 million offer.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And Mark is how old at this point? 18?
He was
19?
20. He just had turned 20 when he was offered $10 million. Yeah.
And according to you, he did not even seriously consider it. In fact, he turned down.
Well, you believe that, I assume. I mean, considering how many times he's turned down money.
He's done it in the past. Yeah. So he's just he's turned down so much money to be acquired of it. Is that why you think he has a little bit of Bill Gates in him? Is that he has, like, he's just going to be a historical
CEO? Well, I think this issue of his attitude toward wealth is quite similar to Bill Gates, in my opinion.
Is it too early to call him Bill Gates yet?
I mean, I'm not calling him Bill Gates. I'm saying he reminded me of him, that's all. I mean, he's not Bill Gates. Bill Gates' achievement is monumental.
And you said he reminds me of
Bill Gates. Zuckerberg's achievement is approaching monumental, by the way, even though it's a much shorter-term thing. But it's pretty damn big. I think both of them were animated by a vision to change the world more than to get rich. That's all I would say about that. And they both, I think, more or less presumed they would get rich, but that wasn't why they were doing it. I mean, that may be too subtle for you, but that's what I think.
You'll pay for that a little later.
I'm sure I will. Even as I was saying it, I was regretting that, actually. I'll knock your glass over.
You say on page something.
You've read it more recently than me. This is unfair.
It's not. No, it's. If I'm debating the book that you wrote with you, that's not an unfair.
It's not unfair.
No.
I'm joking. Just trying to stall for time now.
Let me quote Mark Zuckerberg on the new privacy controls. Quote, we really messed this one up. We did a bad – this is actually a blog post that he wrote that you quoted in the book. We really messed this one up. We did a bad job of explaining the new features. And even worse job of giving you control of them. We didn't build in the proper privacy controls right away. You know what's fascinating to me? That's not from a month ago.
No, it's happened a number of times, hasn't it?
What year was that?
That one, I would guess, was probably 2 years ago. That was the news feed? Yeah. Yeah, that was maybe the most contrite he ever got, was at the news feed. It was the biggest
that
protest.
That could have been from a month ago when they said we kind of messed up on
privacy.
No, there's
an amazing pattern here. There's no question.
Talk to me about that pattern.
Well, there's a clear pattern of Zuckerberg. You know, Zuckerberg really does believe that all of us would be better off sharing more information. And I think he presumptuously, on numerous occasions, has tried to force us to share a little more than we are comfortable doing. And it's just a pattern, but he's got an amazing ability to backpedal just enough to put a little privacy control under the news feed and then move on and have everybody be happy until the next time he does it. And I don't think...
It's happened how many times?
I would say it's happened about five times. About five times noteworthy times. If you include, like, the terms of service controversy and
every time users forget all about it and move on.
More or less. I mean, they don't forget all about it, but more or less. You know, the news feed is the kind of paradigmatic example that he always thinks about, because that was the biggest real protest he ever faced, with 10% of his users, you know, really, protesting actively on the service against the service. And yet, the thing they were protesting later became the most popular central feature of the service.
Let's unpack the news feed a little bit. So, I mean, this was in 2000 and... Oh, you have water?
Did I already drink that?
I have four.
Oh, give me one.
You want one?
Please.
Thank you. The news feed was, we've forgotten about it now, but it was in late 2006, was that right?
Yeah, it was September 2006.
And talk about the world before and after, because that was clearly a pivotal point for Facebook.
Well,
in fact,
before
you said in the book that Sean Parker said that that was the pivotal point where it was going to be decided if Facebook was going to be a more important company than Google. Was the news?
Yeah, that was the way they thought about it before they launched it.
So let's talk about
that.
That
was a quote before they launched it. Yeah. Well, you know, before the news feed, the way you used Facebook was you kind of cruised. You were a voyeur. You just cruised all over and looked at your friends' profiles when you had time, you know. And the news feed became a distribution mechanism. A lot of things I said earlier really are only a function now of the news feed's existence. The news feed was this sort of automation that they brought into the whole system where they initially just posted on your friends' pages, or posted on your page what your friends had recently changed on their profile. And interestingly, when they first did that, it was perceived by the users of Facebook as a massive intrusion and invasion of privacy. It is very interesting.
And we don't even think about it now.
We don't even think about it. Yeah, isn't that ironic? I mean, and this is what Zuckerberg thinks about when he looks at the current kind of situation. And I think he overemphasizes past history sometimes when he has a problem like he recently had. And he kind of still, he even said somewhere, I don't think it was something he said to me. I think I read it somewhere that he said this one would just blow over too. I know he thinks that. He thinks that.
But it already has.
Well, why though? Why do you think it has?
People don't care. Very short-term memory, right? And Facebook is such a. Remember, Facebook's going to bring world peace, right?
So you're saying he's right.
And if Facebook's going to bring world peace, as you said in the that it's just so important of a utility to us today that. I mean, who cares if people see the pictures we didn't want them to see of us drinking in college and
Shall we talk about privacy for a minute? Because I really do have – I think that Facebook really has some sort of conceptual and design problems that it has not remedied, that it should remedy, in my opinion. And this whole issue of opt-in versus opt-out, that's kind of the fundamental question. And you know, pretty much everything on Facebook, to the degree they've been able to make it so, has always been – opt out. They make a decision for you, and if you don't like it, you undo it. And the best example of that we're all so familiar with is tagging in photos. You know, you cannot untag yourself until somebody tags you first, and it's been distributed to all your friends. That's ridiculous. You should be able to prove the tag before it goes on there in the first place. That's opt in. Okay. But really, the same logic applies to all these issues about, you know, the Open Graph API. And many other things. But the presumption, you know, there is a desire among people at Facebook, primarily Mark and a lot of people who very fervently agree with him, that, you know, it's going to be better for the world if people share more stuff. So they push and they push and they push. But in reality, because, as you yourself just pointed out, most users don't care, it's a little hard for me to argue that they've necessarily been wrong to do that. I have always set my privacy protections to friends only. Now, you know, and I didn't like it when they showed my friends to everybody on the service, which they did for about the last 6 months. And now you don't have to have that anymore, and now my friends are hidden again. But, you know, Mark thinks it's better for you if you share more, and that you're going to be able to do more stuff if everybody shares more because there'll be more data to help you make decisions. I mean, that's sort of the basic mindset. And, you know, you could argue that the average user of Facebook intrinsically agrees with them based on their behavior.
Is anyone in the audience not a current Facebook user? Not a current, you don't have a profile.
You don't have a profile?
Really?
Whoa.
Okay, so hands down. Did anyone in the audience who is a current Facebook user actually delete their account and keep it deleted based on all this privacy stuff? See, no one. No.
Three hands, yep. Yeah.
Come on. Really? So in the last 60 days, you've deleted your Facebook account.
Four people.
I did and I recreated
He did and he recreated it, this guy over here. Yeah.
Have you talked to Facebook at all about this? And you know,
about what?
Whether they've had any kind of hiccup in user growth? Because what I've heard from them is nothing.
Well, at the press conference about 3 weeks ago, Mark very clearly said we've seen no data that shows user behavior has changed during this period.
The scary thing about Facebook is they have 500 million users roughly today. Their growth rate today is higher than it's really ever been, right? They continue to grow faster.
I think actually their growth rate is slower as a percentage.
They are growing so fast.
They're growing they're growing in the vicinity of a million new users a day on a base of 500 million. That's kind
of
incredible.
At some point. I mean, There's how many people are on the internet? 1.3 billion.
You get different. Okay. I think 1.6 is a figure I've heard that sounds about.
I mean,
right.
That's going to be everyone. Are they the most? When you think about 100 years from now, are they a more important company than any other company?
100 years from now, they won't exist. That would be. I just can't believe they'd exist in 100 years. Nothing in
will
the internet. First of all,
years?
We won't even think. There will be nothing called the internet in 100 years.
What?
I mean, I don't even think that's debatable because
what?
The internet's just it's just something we use now. I mean,
we're recording this, right?
In 100 years, I mean,
100 years ago,
in 100 years, it's all
going to
be telepathic, and we're all going to be disembodied.
Awesome.
I mean, come on. If you just look at technology trends, that's not a joke.
I don't think we're going to be telepathic in 100 years.
I mean, that's facetious, but we're going to have things that are way, 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 way beyond what we can envision now. And I don't know what they are because I can't envision them, but they're not going to be the internet, I'll tell you that.
I mean, Benioff is shaking his head yes. I'm waiting for him to give me a cue to jump in, so I'm not going to attack him.
I know I agree with him.
So, Mark, you agree in 100 years we're
going to
be telepathic and we're going to be beyond the internet at that point. I think that's an interesting debate to have separately as well. Okay. Let's talk about we're going to get to questions here.
I mean, I'm sure Facebook will be around for a while, some percentage of the next 100 years probably, although, you know, it is a very, very competitive landscape on the internet, as you write about more than anybody. And, I don't think you can assume that Facebook has a sinecure forever. And
What?
That they have a guaranteed position. You know, basically, I think one of the reasons Facebook makes all these changes all the time is because they're running paranoid and they feel they have to continually evolve the service.
I think they have 10 years of domination. I've written about this. So Google had a good 10 years. Microsoft had 10, 15 years. I think they have 10 years.
Has it begun, the 10 years now?
I think it's just starting now. In my opinion, we're just sort of getting to the point.
That sounds reasonable to me.
They can do whatever they want. No one can touch them for a decade.
It's probably true, but they could really screw up on this privacy thing and really get screwed, in my opinion. That could still happen. If every government on the planet started protesting loudly that their citizens' rights were being violated by Facebook, which actually is starting to happen, then
the EU doesn't care. They just want the money, right? So they use Microsoft as an ATM machine, and they're going to use Google as an ATM machine. They're eventually going to there's no way to protect your – and, you know, Asia doesn't seem to care at all about user privacy. So, except
– Well, Facebook is not even in Asia, so to speak, because they're not in China. I mean,
I bet they have a lot of Chinese users. But how do they –
They only have like 20 or 30,000 in China because it's turned off anybody but government users.
How? Okay.
You know, the sensors use it, basically, I would assume.
How do they stumble? Like, really, how do they stumble?
I'm not saying I expect them to stumble. I just say you can't rule out the possibility that they will. You know, I think they've – one of the reasons people ask me all the time, is Mark Zuckerberg the long-term CEO? You know, all I can say is he's done a pretty damn good job so far. You know, I mean
– That's a good segue into my next question.
Okay.
Because I want to talk about Sean Parker a little bit, and then I want to go to the audience questions. There's some really good ones in here, some good zingers. But Sean Parker is this hugely colorful character in the book.
Yeah.
And he's a friend of mine, but there's a lot of things I learned about him in this book. So he was the co-founder of Napster. He was fired. He founded Plaxo. He was fired. Like, there's a huge amount of sort of turmoil and controversy around that. He comes into Facebook, and he clearly creates a culture in Facebook that's anti-venture capitalist.
Right.
That has reverberated through the company even until today.
Absolutely correct.
Can you talk a little bit about like how big of an like what? How did he get involved in the company? What is it? He was so anti-venture capitalist, and Mark relied on him so much.
I think of Sean Parker as one of the technology industry's great visionaries, and I think he's a fantastically interesting personality. He actually figured out intellectually that something like Facebook was going to come along, and he went around looking for it. And he contacted Mark and Eduardo in like March of 2004 when the service was less than 2 months old and said, I want to talk about working with you guys in some way. Out of the blue. And they were like, yeah, we'll have dinner, but what do we need you for? And then they ran into him on the street at this fabled encounter in Palo Alto. And, you know, they shared a lot of ideas. And Sean had no place to live, in effect. So I invited him to live in their house. And by the end of August, he was the president of Facebook. And he had been kicked out of Plaxo, and he really hated Mike Moritz and venture capitalists in general. And he basically convinced Mark that they would screw him. And so he figured out a way to structure the company so that Mark had absolute total control, which is amazing. And this is an amazing thing about Facebook. People have been so into it so early, so passionately, the investor community, that they were able to get away with, you know, Excel giving them almost $13 million without undoing this control that Mark had of the board. It's the same kind of thing now that people are willing to buy Facebook shares at a $26 billion valuation, and they're practically fighting over, they're tumbling over each other to do it. If you have any shares of Facebook, you could probably sell them for $35 billion right now. There's so many people that want shares of Facebook, and they don't even really have a profit model. I mean, and they've been this way from the beginning. It's just incredible. I mean, that's what makes it such an amazing story to write. That's why I wrote the book. This is all this weird stuff in this company is unprecedented.
Well, we're going to go to some audience questions, if that's all right.
It's not. You're in charge here.
No, I'm not in charge. I got this note saying I need you to ask audience questions, and so. Am I supposed to hit the gavel now? There's something I'm supposed to do when we move to audience questions. No one's even paying attention at this point back there. All right, well, I'll look at that in a second. I do have to read something. I have to what? You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And our speaker today is David Kirkpatrick, journalist and author of The Facebook Effect, the inside story of the company that is connecting the world. I got that out of the way.
You even did the right voice for that.
So here's a great question about Chris Kelly. So Chris Kelly was the chief privacy officer of Facebook, left to run for attorney general.
Yeah.
I actually love him. I endorsed him, even though he's a liberal Democrat. I think he has a lot of really good policies. I thought he was, you know, I thought the guy could be president someday. Mm-hmm. He got his butt kicked in the primary. And so do you think that's Facebook's fault?
I would assume that one of the reasons was that he was so closely identified with the company. And let's face it, he didn't define solely the privacy policies, but he was the main privacy guy.
Was he the only fallout from this recent privacy disaster?
The only what?
Well, there's this recent privacy.
I don't think that's
disaster.
The only reason he lost. I assume. I'm not a student of California politics, but
no, I have no idea. But is that the only? I mean, there's this huge privacy blow up. Facebook doesn't even lose any users. We've got four people in the audience that apparently they're the only ones that have turned off Facebook accounts. Is the only fallout from all of that, is it Chris Kelly lost or was he going to lose anyway?
I don't know. But I think it certainly contributed to his loss. And honestly, if you're mad at Facebook, you can't agree with Chris Kelly on privacy because he's really the architect of most of what they did. And, I mean, he was the lawyer who, you know, figured out how to justify it and all. But it's, you know, it was mostly Mark's impulses that led to it. But well, so, you know, if he's paying a price for Facebook's privacy policies, it's not entirely unjust is all I'm saying.
So there's a couple of the questions have been about, you know, competition and what does Facebook have to worry about from a competitive standpoint. Mark has actually, I think today he said, right, that he's maybe worried too much about Twitter.
Yeah, he said that this week, yeah.
What do they have to worry about? Anything at all, or do they just have to worry about executing?
I think, you know, what Mark tells me and I say in the book, as you'll recall, is that what he worries about most is changing the service at the pace that it needs to be changed without alienating this huge mass of hundreds of millions of users. That's his biggest managerial challenge. And it's a huge one. I would say there is another thing that he really ought to be worried about, and I don't know. I think he thinks about it. Whether he worries about it, I don't know, is governmental interference and regulatory pushback. I think that it's going to be real, and it's already happening. And, you know, every big tech company has encountered it to one degree or another, IBM, Microsoft, you know, et cetera, especially those two. And I think, by the way, Apple's going to encounter it in the not-distant future, I would assume. But they've stayed away from it for a long time by not being very big, in effect. But Facebook's so big, you know, bigness brings on all kinds of antagonists. When you're the so overwhelmingly dominant player, especially when you're doing something so sensitive as managing people's personal information, that is just a set of policy challenges that are monumental. And I think it's hard to imagine that a company led by a 26-year-old is going to make all the right decisions on that. I do think, on balance, he's done a decent job so far. But he's made some big mistakes, as we've discussed. But the challenges are going to get much bigger. You know, it's funny. There was the first review of my book was in Publishers Weekly, and it said that it was a good book, but probably too late because the furor over Facebook seems to have subsided. And then, like, 2 weeks later, this whole thing erupted, and senators started writing letters. I mean, it was a whole different order of magnitude. This was really a furor when Chuck Schumer is writing letters to every member of MoveOn.org as a fundraiser criticizing Facebook. You know, that's different than, you know, Jason Calacanis complaining, you know?
Here's a good question. What do you think about – I haven't heard these rumors, but what do you think about rumors that Facebook reads the email of its enemies?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
What do you think about rumors that Facebook
reads that's one of the things that
email of its
in
enemies.
The recent IM
I bet they
stuff,
read your emails, do you think? Like how's the book going? Let's check out, you know, David's emails.
I really doubt that they do that. I mean, they certainly could do it technically. They have all this data about all of us. I think their corporate policies are very, very rigid about that, and that's all I can tell you. I think there have been cases where people have violated their own internal rules and been fired. I think there were times much earlier in the company's evolution where they had a much more casual attitude towards that kind of stuff, and that even came out in some of Nicholas Carlson's anonymous IM stuff that he's published. You know, I think it sounds like when Mark was still a freshman, sophomore at Harvard, and Facebook was a couple months old, he was more or less inviting people to look at data inside Facebook, which is a bad thing, but it was just a college sort of silly thing he was doing at the time. He didn't even want to keep doing it. I mean, isn't it amazing that story? I mean, I think this is amazing.
How do you know he didn't want to keep doing it?
Well, it is. In the fall of 2004, he really wished that he would just work on WireHog. He had to be, like, pulled back into Facebook by Sean and Dustin because he wanted to do WireHog, which he thought was a more interesting project than Facebook.
Yeah.
That was when it already had a million users. I think that's incredible.
So you're saying he didn't want to work on Facebook
anymore? I'm saying he thought of it as sort of a lark until roughly that period and suddenly said, yeah, maybe I better focus on this one.
What is Zuckerberg's greatest weakness?
Well, you know,
also, this person wants to have a meeting with him.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that in a way, his biggest strength is his greatest weakness, as is so often the case. He's a geek programmer, you know, computer scientist that's trying to lead a company that encounters massive public policy challenges. And, you know, you can't solve every problem with programming and product design. And that's the attitude he's had up to now. And I think that's a risk. You know, he's going to have to learn to do this stuff that he hates, like sit at D and get grilled by Walt Mossberg and Kara Swisher and handle it gracefully. And, you know, if he can't do that, he's going to have a real serious set of problems because he's going to be doing that all the time.
What do you think of the executive team he's put around him at this point?
I think it's superbly high quality. And I think Sheryl Sandberg was an amazingly good hire.
Say one negative thing about one member of the executive team.
Well, that would be – I'm not rude, and I don't think that would be – that's just not my style.
Okay, anyway. So but let's – do your readers –
I said something mildly negative about Chris Kelly before, actually.
Do your readers have a right – don't you have an obligation to your readers to be not rude but to be brutally honest across the board?
I'm a pretty honest person. The fact is, I believe in the significance of Facebook, and I had a point of view when I wrote the book, and I'm not apologizing for it, you know? And if somebody else wants to write a book about all the problems with Facebook, I would love to read it.
Yeah.
Seriously. And, you know, I wrote the history of Facebook as I saw it from the point of view that it's a very impactful service that was likely to get bigger, and I started doing that when it had 50 million users. So call me an idiot. You know, what can I say?
No, you definitely, you know, saw it coming. And I'm not going to call you an idiot. I don't think you are an idiot. Is Facebook a good breeding ground for scammers, not just Scamville? They don't care about security. They're like an open database with real identity of people.
It's a very good question, and
but,
the answer is probably
about
yes.
But a lot of personal data.
I mean, when even Jim Breyer got phished and his Facebook account, you know, taken over, you realize it's very easy to have it happen. He's on the board of the company. It didn't happen for long, I think security on Facebook is going to be really problematic because it's like Windows now. It's going to become the system that everybody wants to attack. They're pretty good. You know, one of the things that amazes me, by the way, is that it's almost never really gone down and been unusable for an extended period of time. And that's incredible. Look at Twitter. Like the other day, I was trying to use Twitter for like 5 hours and I couldn't get on the damn thing. So they've got some really good programming talent there, and they've got a lot of very smart security people, but they're going to have to get smarter security people. That's a really good question because, you know that the attacks are going to come and a lot of people are going to have bad things happen. But this is one reason, by the way, that I always say that, I don't put anything on Facebook that I would be unhappy to see on the front page of the newspaper. And I feel like that's just good common sense because,
Facebook tell its users that?
No, I actually think they should tell their users that. And there are quite a few people in the company who more or less think that same thing.
But also people are putting pictures up of their friends. It's not just
you're
putting
stuff up. I don't even put pictures up of my family.
Sure. But, you can imagine putting pictures up. Your friend's drunk. He's wasted. He's passed out on your couch.
Right.
That's going to be funny. Let's get a picture, of that up on Facebook. And the friend may not think it's quite as funny. So
right. Well, that's a really interesting thing.
That goes to your point before about maybe making people approve a tag before.
Yeah. I mean, this whole theme of peer-to-peer privacy violations that I talk about in the book where, really a lot of the problems, the biggest problems people have had with privacy on Facebook stem from accepting friends that aren't really their friends. Because when you accept a friend on Facebook, you are empowering that person to have enormous access and ability to manipulate your personal data and communicate with your friends, etc. So if you don't want that to happen, don't accept friends who you don't know, which just about everybody does. And then they think, why is Facebook screwing over my privacy? But, Facebook makes a lot of mistakes. But a significant percentage of the problems that people have experienced has been of their own making. And Facebook was not designed to be a place to meet new people by friending them and then figure out who they are after the fact.
It's an interesting question about Farmville, and this isn't the question, but I'll ask a different one. Does Facebook need Farmville and Zynga more now than Zynga needs Facebook?
Absolutely not. I think they need each other. I mean, obviously, Facebook really, really doesn't want Zynga to get unhappy, but, I think actually Facebook had a lot more leverage in those negotiations than was generally talked about. I mean, Zynga's a creature of Facebook, and the most successful creature of Facebook by far, commercially. But if it can't just kiss Facebook goodbye. It can't. It would be insane. That would be suicidal. But Facebook's getting big enough that even Zynga is, they don't really need any one partner. I mean, it would be a blow. Reportedly rumored, they've got $50 million in ad revenue from Zynga in 2009. I mean, that's the most interesting figure, I think, about that relationship, which was by far their single biggest advertiser since. And if they did have roughly $500 million in revenue, that's 10%. They don't want that to go away. But could they live without it? Yes. Could Zynga live without Facebook? Absolutely not.
And we're winding down now, a couple more questions. Why has Facebook ignored the sort of location-based services, the Foursquare and Gowalla space?
Well, in that same interview you were quoting from before this week, Zuckerberg said, we are doing it.
Oh, they've been talking about it for quite a while, but they haven't actually dipped their toes into the pool
yet.
Why is that?
I think most of us users of Facebook will be glad they did. I mean,
is it because they're concerned about, there are real privacy issues here and personal security issues?
I think that's a very good – that's insightful, actually. I think, in fact, they're freaked out by all the heat they've gotten recently, and there's a lot of things they would like to do that they're holding off on until they're really convinced that they've moved beyond this controversy. And it's very possible that location-based innovation is one of those things because when your location gets entered into the picture of, data about you – some of these privacy things become even more complicated. They don't want to get blamed for you having your house broken into, So, you know, I think they'll figure it out. But you're going to, unfortunately for them, you're going to see them moving more slowly, which is something that I'm sure drives Mark Zuckerberg up a tree. But that's the consequence of having all these people and all this attention and, you know, being under a microscope. You've got to watch your step.
Is this a potential weakness for them? Are they waiting too long and letting some of these companies, some of the competitors get too big?
Well, in a way you could say yes, but then if you look at, Foursquare is one of their major competitors, or Gowalla, you know, those companies both are built on the Facebook platform, effectively. You know, their distribution and their is predominantly through Facebook, so at least as far as I understand it. And so, you know, that's not a bad thing for Facebook. You know, and then certainly I think it would be logical that they might buy Foursquare or another company of that type. Don't you?
I don't know why they wouldn't have done it already.
I don't either, to be honest.
I think that they want – there's a – since you asked, I think that there's a combination of wait and see, so you don't screw around. Let somebody else figure it out because you're big enough to wait.
Yeah.
And I think there are some real issues around, you know, people being – you know, what if a husband forces his wife to turn on the stud check-in and things like that? I think there's a real security issue here.
Well, I mean, like I said, I mean – if, you know, if a crook knows you're away because they saw it on Facebook, they go rob your house. I mean, that's you don't want that to happen.
Yeah. What do you think Facebook's revenues are right now?
I think this year it'll, you know, I'm not any better than a lot of other guessers at that. I have had occasional conversations where I had brief insight, but it changes so fast. I would guess $1.2 billion this year is the range.
That's a pretty specific guess.
It's just a guess. Yeah, I worked at Fortune for years. We used to always do that kind of thing. An estimated $1.2 billion.
Mark, you know, what do you think the revenues are?
Between 1 and 2.
So let's break that down a little bit. So their revenue sources are...
Well, you know, interestingly, their number one revenue source is ads from small advertisers on a self-service platform. Yeah.
And...
And number two would be direct ad sales and what they consider engagement ads, which are primarily on, you know, your main home newsfeed homepage. And I would guess, I think last year that was in the vicinity of 100 million. I would say this year, because it's growing really, interest by like major national and global advertisers is growing quite rapidly. So I would guesstimate that it'd be 250, 300 million this year maybe. They would love to build that up.
And
then they have two other major sources of revenue.
Credits and... Gifts?
Credits and gifts. Yeah, credits and virtual goods,
So
credits is not a large number, but, wasn't that interesting at your conference in response to a question you asked? I think Sean said 30% of Facebook's revenues this year could be credits. I find that surprising and hard to believe, actually, but he knows a lot.
So we're talking about $1 or $2 billion in revenue. Google is 20, what, $4 billion now? Most of that search marketing, something like that. How does Facebook get to those kind of numbers?
That's a great question.
They already have everyone, right? Everyone's a member. Everyone's generating all these page views.
Yeah.
Will they get to 20, 30 billion in revenue in the next few years?
I mean,
Mark says yes.
If you look at the trajectory, I think they're roughly on a trajectory similar to Google in terms of their revenue so far. You know, sixth year, seventh year, a billion to 2 billion. I think that's ballpark where Google was. You know, Mark's attitude is to seek ubiquity first and figure out the money thing later. And they all say that, you know, he said that kind of in
this
interview.
I don't think that's what Sheryl thinks, though.
Right? I think she doesn't really entirely agree with it, but she knew that's what he thought when she signed on, and she's willing to go with it because it's not a surprise to her. You know, she is a monetization expert, an ad expert, a business person par excellence, and... You know, but the great thing about having her there is at any point where they need more money, you know, if Zynga drops them or something, which, like, you know, if that were to happen, you know, they've got a lot of levers to pull to increase the revenue if they wanted to. I mean, they've always had the ability to get more revenue in the short term if they wanted to, in the opinion of Mark, diminish the quality of the user experience. And I think that's going to remain true. And I think, you know, if they got it to 1 billion people next year, which I think is not inconceivable, you know, maybe at that point they'll say, you know, now's the time to really start advertising more. But, you know, Mark doesn't even believe in advertising. That's one of the weird things. You know, he actually thinks commercial messages that you want to receive are fine. Yeah. But something that you consider intrusive, he'd rather never be on Facebook. And that's a high bar to set for commercial partners.
All right, that's all we have time for.
Oh.
Our thanks.
I came out of this less scathed than I expected.
Well, my review is going up shortly, and I'm going to recommend that people buy the book.
Thank you.
But actually, it was a really nice conversation to have. I understood a few more things. Our thanks, back to the script, to David Kirkpatrick, journalist and author of The Facebook Effect, the inside story of the company that is connecting the world. We also thank our audiences here on radio, television, and the internet.
Thank you, Michael.
No, we're supposed
can I say
to pause.
Thank you
no, hold on. We have a 3-second pause so they can edit it out. Okay, we want to remind our audience in the room that Mr. Kirkpatrick will sign copies of his book in the lobby at the conclusion of the program. I think that's now, right before the next session starts. I think that's a yes. We appreciate your allowing him to get to the signing table as quickly as possible, so let him run over to that. Wait, I get to bang the gavel now. Oh, no, wait, I'm Michael Arendt. All right, we're done. Thanks.
That was good.
Thanks. Good question.